You're listening to Money Management, powered by the Opus 111 Group. Here with a fresh perspective on the market, the economy, and your money. From the Spokane office of the Opus 111 Group, Mike Mail.
Well, good morning and welcome to Money Management with Mike Mail. This is Jim Harvey, president of Opus 111 Group. Today, I'm substituting for your regular host, Mike Mail, who is a senior vice president of our firm and who oversees our Spokane branch. I will also be joined by my son, Andrew Harvey, who will do our weekend market report and economic news, as well as one other segment of the show. If you have any questions you'd like us to address in future money management shows, please email them to info@opus111group.com, and we will either answer them directly or during next week's show. We also encourage and invite you to visit our website for the latest on the markets, listen to our video and audio podcasts, and our perspectives on how you can manage your portfolio in a way that enhances your ability to achieve your financial goals, help you sleep more soundly at night, and live the lives you've imagined. In a few minutes, I will turn things over to my son, Andrew, who will provide you with key market closing data after Friday's close and economic news for the week. Then, after a commercial break, we will have three segments covering topics that we have found are on top of mind of our clients. Number one, the real impacts of presidential elections on the stock market. The second segment is financial preparedness for the unexpected, how you should prepare for a financial emergency. And the last is three key questions that we are hearing from our clients today. The first is, I've been hearing a lot about layoffs starting to occur. How should I prepare? The second is, shouldn't I just buy a one-year CD since rates are hovering around 5%? And then finally, what about all this talk of Fed rate cuts and the impacts on interest rates, inflation, and the possibility of a recession? So now I'm going to turn things over to Andrew Harvey, who will bring you up to speed on the closing data on the markets and key economics news for the week. Andrew, take it away.
Thanks for that, Jim. Let's start by taking a look at this week's numbers from the S&P 500. The S&P wound up closing out the week at 4890.97. On the whole, that's about a 0.75% increase over the past five trading days. Markets were largely flat on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, up slightly Wednesday, down slightly Monday, Friday, but so small as to not really be of a distinction. But there were some pretty sizable bumps on Tuesday and Thursday of about a 0.5 percentage point apiece. Overall, the S&P 500 is up 2.5% so far here in 2024. That marks a 21.78% increase from 1 year ago. The Dow is up 1.11%. That's a 12.25% increase from this time in 2023. And the NASDAQ, the big winner out of the three right now, it's up 33% from this time last year and about 3% so far this year. The Russell 2000 is down slightly in 2024, down 2.34%, but it is up 3.5% from this time 12 months ago. The FTSE in the UK is down 1.62% from a year ago, but is up 2% so far this year. The Nikkei index in Japan, also a big gain over the past 12 months, 30.66%, and it's up 6.83% so far this year. Crude oil up 9.13% so far this year, but it is still down about 3.5% from where it was 12 months ago. Gold down slightly, just over 2% so far this year, and up 4.75% from 12 months ago. The U.S. 10-year Treasury is up about 19% from a year ago and up 7.6% so far in 2024. That's this week's economic numbers. Here is our other economic news. A new bipartisan bill is hoping to expand the child tax credit for working families. The bill, called the Tax Relief for American Families and Workers Act of 2024, proposes to increase the tax credit for lower-earning families that don't have enough income to fully take advantage of the current tax credit. It also includes benefits for businesses and has passed the House Ways and Means Committee 40-3, could now head to the House floor. The expansion proposes to make the cap on the refundable amount under the tax credit multiply by the number of eligible children. It raises the limit from 15% of income to 15% of income for each child. The bill has the support of the White House, but it is not yet clear if a vote will occur. The Chinese Commerce Minister Wang Wentao said Friday that the country is working with the United States to make trade between the two nations more predictable and stable. The two countries, which represent the world's largest economies, have agreed to hold regular ministerial meetings seeking to create, quote, a good environment for the two countries' economic and trade cooperation, especially in stabilizing business expectations. In the past 2 years, the Biden administration has issued export restrictions, limiting China's ability to buy highly advanced, high-tech semiconductors from U.S. producers, claiming that the technology could grant the Chinese military access to cutting-edge systems. Foreign investment in China fell by 8% in 2023, the lowest level in 3 years, with France and the United Kingdom marking the biggest increases in foreign investment in the country. New economic data out Friday showed that personal income rose about 0.3% in December, matching consensus expectations. Personal consumption was up 0.7% in December. Over the past year, personal income rose about 4.7% across the country, with spending up 5.9%. Meanwhile, data on inflation released the same day indicates that inflation is continuing to slow. The Commerce Department's Personal Consumption Expenditures Index rose 0.2% in December and was up 2.9% for a year-over-year increase, while real consumption, adjusted for inflation, was up 3.2% from 1 year ago. News released earlier the week reported that real gross domestic product, or GDP, increased at a 3.3% annual rate in the fourth quarter of 2023, vaulting past the expected 2% figure. The largest contribution to that increase was the increase in personal consumption. New single-family home sales also saw a big bump to end the year, with an 8% overall jump. Overall, sales are up about 4.4% from 1 year ago. Sales rose in the Northeast, South, and Midwest, but fell out here in the West. The month's supply of new homes, how long it would take to sell all the homes currently available in inventory, declined to 8.2 months in December, down from 8.8 months in November, largely due to a faster pace of sales. Overall, the median price of new homes sold was $413,200 in December, which was a 13.8% decrease from 1 year ago. The average or mean price of new homes sold was also down to $487,300, and that marks a 14.3% decrease from 1 year prior.
This segment, I really want to talk about something that's top of mind, and fortunately or unfortunately, is going to be top of all of our minds for the next several months until November, and that's the presidential election the angst that's created every presidential year going back in perpetuity. And the real question is, what are the real impacts of presidential elections on the stock market, not only in the election year, but all 4 years? Does it make a difference whether it's Democrats or Republicans that are elected and the like? So as we approach this year's presidential elections, many of our clients are troubled by the negativity of political discourse in today's politics. Investor doubts may seem especially prevalent during presidential years when campaigns spotlight the country's challenges. But while the current and economic and political challenges may seem unprecedented, history has shown us repeatedly that controversy and uncertainty are a regular reality. In other words, there have always been tumultuous events in our history, such as geopolitical conflicts and war, like the Israel-Hamas conflict and the Ukraine war going on right now, market declines and recessions, pandemics and other biohazards like COVID, but also Ebola, weather-related calamities like Hurricane Katrina and Sandy, labor market struggles, civil unrest and protests. Yet, even with the election year rhetoric amplifying the negative, it's important, in our opinion, to focus your vision for the future. Because it's perfectly natural to think that if your presidential candidate isn't elected in November, the economy, the stock market, our country, and civilization as we know it will come crashing down. So that really poses the following question: what are the real impacts of presidential elections on stock market performance in those same election years and beyond? So I suggest that let's look at the data and ignore the gut-grinding anxiety that so many of us feel these days. Now, at Opus, we receive countless analytical pieces from reliable sources, which have highlighted some very interesting facts about how the markets are impacted by whether a Republican or a Democrat is elected, whether all three houses of Congress and the executive branch are with a single political party or not. And bottom line, the results are clear. Presidential elections have very little correlation or impacts on the performance of the stock market. For example, since 1949, what happens if if clients only invest during periods where their preferred candidates are in office, Republicans or Democrats, versus staying fully invested during the entire 75-year period? And you know what we find is that you know $10,000 invested in 1949 grows to about, oh, I don't know, $70,000 if you just do Republican candidates, and then it's about, I don't know, about 70,000 if it's Democratic. However, if you ignore it, your $10,000 grows to like $3.2 million. That's the point. And you know, there's an old saw in our business that's not timing the market, it's time in the market. You know, there's also something to bear in mind, which has to do with, you know, particular year returns versus, you know, on upside and downside. And most people forget that we have what we call the rule of 55, 65, and 75. And the rule of 55, 65, and 75 says that the market is up 55% of all trading days. There are 252 during a year, 65 of all trading months, and 75% of all trading years. Well, how does it pan out with respect to the Republicans versus Democrats in the White House? Well, during that period of time, going all the way back to 1928, the market has been up 73% of of all years. And that's the point. Now, you know, if you want to delve more into it, or if you sort of want to aggravate your friend on the other side of the aisle, there's lots of data you can use. I mean, for example, in actual presidential election years, in other words, that would be like in 2024, the data is an interesting mix, especially when you consider the long-term averages between Republican and Democratic administrations. So, for example, the average returns for just election years from 1928 to through 2020 is, when a Republican is elected, it's up 15.8%. When a Democrat is elected, it's up 8.5%. If you combine all of those election years on average, it's up 11.58%. So, you know, obviously, if you're a Republican, you're saying, hey, that's great. You know, we're up almost 16% of the time. That's only, however, in the election year in fact itself. Now, the average return during all Republican administrations since 1929 is up 7.85%. The average return during Democratic administrations was up 14.93%. And the average return over all 4 year terms was up 46%. So that's roughly, you know, 10.2% each. The average return during the first year of an administration is up 9.88%. During the second year, it's up 8.5%. During the third year, it's up 17.6%. And during the fourth year, it's up 10.19%. So, you know, what does it tell us? Well, it tells us that it really kind of doesn't matter. You know, bottom line is, you know, we have had any number of crises going back to, you know, Herbert Hoover's administration in the late 20s and early 30s. And there have been just countless. I mean, you think about all the wars, you know, the Second World War, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, you know, dot dot dot, the Cold War, any number of global issues, and yet that rule of 55, 65, and 75 continues to hold true, despite the fact that, you know, you've got your current emotions tied up in this stuff. You know, the bottom line is that, you know, it really doesn't matter in any given year. And the real question is, should you adjust your investing behavior based on what happens, you know, in the market? Now, There are going to be people that just say, well, I don't care. I just, if Donald Trump or if Biden gets elected, then, I'm taking all my money and putting it in a sock. Well, that just doesn't turn out to be the best way to approach it. Now, another thing that's quite interesting is if you go back to the first year, the first a mutual fund that American Funds or Capital Group started, which was 1934, the Investment Company of America. If you put $10,000 to work in that through 2022, it grew to $94 million in the S&P. All right. Now, I can't give you the actual return of that fund, which is substantially higher. But the point is that even if you just say, okay, if I just park my money in the S&P 500 and I don't touch it, and during that, long period of time from 1934 through 19, or 2022, your rate of return was 10.8%, which is remarkably similar to what the figures are when we're looking at, does it make sense to invest or to ignore presidential politics as a determining factor in making your decision. So, it may be fun to poke your friend on the other side of the political aisle about whether it's better or worse that your party's candidate or theirs is elected. And it's fun for banter. But in our opinion, it's absolute folly to make your investment decisions about whether you buy or sell out of your stocks portfolios based on elections, years, and election results. Again, the key to being an effective investor isn't timing the market, it's time in the market.
Well, January is almost to a close, and I don't know about you, but I've certainly slipped up on a few of the resolutions that I had set for the coming year. Regrettably, my love of cheeseburgers seems to outweigh my interest in getting in better shape. That said, I still don't think it's too late to take some time and set one more resolution for the year, so I have a bit of a challenge for you, and we'll get into it over the course of this segment if you're up for it. Now is a really great time to commit yourself to getting fully financially prepared for unexpected circumstances, both this year and beyond. And if you set out a list of goals now, you can systematically work to get yourself fully organized by the end of the year, or by the end of next month, really, if you're diligent. One of the things I do at Opus 111 Group is run our sci-fi program for young investors who want to get serious about setting themselves up for the future. While the actual asset management is a key part of what we do in that program, I think the education piece is just as important. After all, who of us couldn't benefit from having locked down good habits earlier in life? As part of the program, I aim to send out about 2 emails a month, and the one I sent out yesterday was talking about the importance of being prepared for financially, potentially devastating, but ultimately highly unexpected events. And I put that email together using tips from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which is FEMA for the acronymically inclined. They have a wealth of resources about being prepared for general emergencies, but also how to stay financially prepared as well. Now at Opus, every year we run a program for our clients in partnership with a local estate planning attorney, and we call it Organize Your Health, Estate, and Finances. And part of that program, participants go through the process of tracking down all the critical documents that they might need access to in an emergency. Wills, powers of attorney, advanced medical directives, copies of insurance policies, deeds, the list goes on and on. And normally, as time goes by, this paperwork gets spread out all over the place if you file things like I do. So this is all about taking the time to track it all down and putting it in order so that if you or someone close to you needs to, they can find those documents when it matters most. FEMA has a similar kind of guide system available to you, and they call it an Emergency Financial First Aid Kit. They shorten it to EFAC, which I'm pretty sure I'm allowed to say on the radio, but if you hear a beep, it was EFFAK. You can go online and search for that Emergency Financial First Aid Kit and start to go through collecting all your documents to help get yourself organized for an emergency. While you're putting everything together, it's also a great time to review all those documents and make sure they're accurate and correct. Addresses, beneficiaries, and legal names are all important things to keep track of across all your paperwork as life's changes take place. So my challenge for you is to go online, download that emergency financial first aid kit from FEMA, and take an hour each weekend to put the work in on that thing until it's finished. Then set a calendar reminder in your phone every January to go back and review it to make sure it's up to date. Think about how much relief you could feel knowing that, you know, all the important documents are, one, being reviewed on a regular basis, but two, is accessible somewhere to you if you actually need to get at it. And we often direct people to take a look at kind of water and fire resistant safes, many of which are, you know, the right size to store those documents and will not break the budget too badly. So by getting ready that way, you know, you've put yourself on a great initial base to kind of, you know, be in control and know where everything is. But there's some other things that we often advise people to do to help be prepared for uncertainty. And the two biggest ones are having adequate cash reserves and examining their disability insurance coverage. Generally, as far as the cash reserves go, we think about 3 months of total necessary expenses. So think gas, groceries, mortgage payments, insurance premiums, medications. 3 months is kind of that minimum that a household will want to keep available in checkings and a savings account with your bank. For retired folks, we often bump that to closer to about 12 months. You know, the money could earn more if it was invested in the market, but the important thing is that you know you've got access to it quickly, and that it's not going to potentially decrease in value if there's a big downward market move. So sit down and try to budget out, you know, your necessary expenses to get a sense of what that monthly figure looks like for you. And then, you know, just multiply it by how many months worth you feel like you need to be comfortable, truly comfortable, right, in the event that you were to suddenly lose your job. It's a real relief to not feel like you're at risk of going into the red right away if your primary source of income stops. And honestly, that relief can be worth the trade-off on the potential lack of returns on that money that you're keeping there in cash. Now, disability insurance is a trickier thing. It's way more complicated than a cash reserve. Disability insurance is an insurance product designed to pay you some percentage of your normal income, usually about 60% of your normal income, if you become disabled and are unable to work. There are a million different types of disability insurance out there, you know, ranging from coverage periods anywhere from a few months to many, many years. Some people can even get disability insurance out to age 65. So if they became permanently disabled, this insurance would continue to pay them till age 65. And we bring it up here in our emergency preparedness segment because a lot of people go around and tell themselves, well, it'll never happen to me, but the math is a little bit trickier than you might suspect. So the Social Security Administration says that 1 in 4 adults in the United States over the age of 18 will become disabled at some point before reaching their full retirement age. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to be disabled permanently, but depending on the length of time they're laid up, they might be out of pocket for a lot of their ongoing living costs. I can relate to this very personally. Last year, I blew out my knee playing sports. And I'm very fortunate. I work at a desk job. I was able to, you know, keep working from home on a laptop when I was laid up and recovering. But if I'd had a job that required me to be on my feet, it was not a workplace accident, so there would have been no workman's comp claim. And I would have been unable to work and help keep a roof over me and my wife's head. So, you know, in that situation, disability insurance could have been a real lifesaver. Now, it's true that there's also Social Security disability benefits that can be available to those people who do become disabled. But it's important to note that SSDI, which is what Social Security Disability Benefits gets, you know, shortened to, it doesn't cover short-term disability, and it can be a really long, drawn-out process to get your benefits in force and actually start to get the money coming in. It's also worth noting that SSDI benefits are taxable to those who make over $25,000 a year for a single filer or 32,000 for joint filers. Likewise, if you have disability insurance through your work, right, your employer offers it as a part of their benefits package, and you need to remember that those disability benefits are going to be taxed if you ever need to draw on them if you become disabled. A private policy, right, what's called kind of an after-tax policy that you put in force with your own money, that pays out tax-free in the event of a disability, basically because the money that is used to pay the insurance premiums that comes out of, say, your bank account, you're already paying the income taxes on that. So that can be a real difference maker, you know, especially for kind of high earners with disability insurance, if their benefits were still taxable versus not being taxed, right? The top marginal bracket rate for income in the United States right now is 37%. So, you know, can be a lot. So I think everybody really needs to consider disability insurance if you're still working. It's a really important part of protecting the rest of your portfolio that a lot of people overlook. And coverage is usually priced according to your health and how hazardous your occupation is. So it's not necessarily as expensive as you might think it would be.
I really want to go over some questions that clients have been asking. And the first one kind of surrounds the whole thing that we're starting to see for the first time in a number of years. And that's massive layoffs announced. Microsoft, for example, Thursday announced that it's laying off 1,900 employees from its video game workforce, which is 9% of its staff in that section. eBay also announced a 9% reduction in its staff. SAP, a German software company, will lay off or job restructure, and we'll talk about that, like voluntary restructure, 8,000 employees. Citigroup will cut 20,000 employees from its staff as part of its corporate overhaul. BlackRock is trimming 3% of its headcount, or roughly 600 people, in its third round of layoffs in the last year. And then even something that's near and dear to my heart as a former sports writer up in Anchorage, Alaska, Sports Illustrated is laying off 100 of its employees. So here's the question, you know, if you've been presented with either a voluntary buyout or worse, involuntary buyout, here are a few things that you should consider before you accept. Now, a voluntary buyout, you know, you might say, well, the money is good. And if I don't do it, then non-voluntary or outright being fired layoffs are next. But if you do receive a buyout deal, first assess the financial value of the package, because that's something to consider. So what are some of those questions that you might want to think about? First of all, how many months of severance pay will you get? I just spoke with a client earlier this week and she got laid off and she's getting 10 weeks. You know, are you getting 10 weeks? Are you getting more? Are you getting less? Will you have health coverage? And if so, for how long? Now, a lot of companies have COBRA, and COBRA is temporary. In most circumstances, you can stay on COBRA for 18 to 36 months. However, you usually pay the full premium yourself plus a small administrative fee. Now, you should contact your employer's benefits or HR department to learn about your COBRA options. And the other thing to bear in mind is, are these premiums affordable or what other options do you have? So, for example, in my company, I cover 75% of the costs of my employees' health care. And then so if they go on COBRA, then they're 100% doing it. So even though they may have been paying a much lower level, now suddenly they may be paying a lot more. Another few questions to think about when you're talking to your HR department. How are your retirement benefits affected? For example, if you have a pension, you know, how many months or years of your pension will be affected by being laid off? If you have a 401k plan and the company does matching, how would that work? And in severance pay in particular, can you continue to make contributions while you're getting your severance pay for, you know, 10 weeks? And if so, would the employer continue to match? The last thing that I would offer, in terms of sitting down, is make sure if you're getting a written letter of recommendation, that you get it in writing before you sign anything, because they have no obligations to do so after the fact. Now, another thing you can do to try not to get laid off right away, or if they're giving you some voluntary things, is to say, well, listen, can I stay into my job but under different leadership or on another team? If not, try to seek an additional month or two of severance pay based on your performance and tenure, or an extra 6 months of health insurance. The worst possible outcome of all of these is that you have that you get laid off without any benefits whatever, and that's what you want to avoid. Okay, so the next question that we're getting a lot of has to do with the Fed. And going back a couple of years, the Fed has hiked 21 times or something. It's the biggest increase in Fed rates in history, and gone from literally zero to 550, 575, which is where it is right now. So the real question is, and there are a lot of people on Wall Street speculating about, well, okay, they're going to cut it 3 times or 6 times or 12 times. Well, nobody really knows. Chairman Powell has indicated that, he stopped hiking and he wants to see how things are looking, and that totally makes sense. But, this is all to trying to control inflation without creating a recession, and it's a push-pull. So, the consumer price is basically up about 3.7% year over year, which is still a lot further down than it was. It was up at 7-8%, and now it's down to 3.7%. But the Fed's target is 2%. Now, I have been consistent in saying that I do not feel that trying to get it down to 2% is likely. Part of the reason for that is that coming out of the credit crisis of 07 to 09, the Fed had to do what it did, which is basically make money absolutely costless so that member banks and our banking system could quietly recapitalize. We were so over-leveraged at that time, they had to do that, and they kept it low for a long time. Now, obviously, COVID boosted it way up. But since then, so the consensus right now is that the Fed will do 3 projected cuts of up to a total of about 0.75% in 2024. But I think it will only do those beyond and much beyond that if inflation and unemployment data support it. Now, the thing to remember is that unemployment is currently 3.7%. So it's under 4% is considered full employment, at least recently. It's interesting because I was in the business in the 1980s, and pundits at that point said full employment was anything under 5%. So things change. But remember one thing about unemployment: it's a lagging indicator. So there's that. So what does this mean? Well, I do think that for interest rates, I think interest rates are going to come down, but which part of the curve? The short end of the curve. I don't expect the long end of the curve to do much. And I do think inflation will continue to be more of a factor than it has over the last 30 years, where it's averaged 2%. The thing that you have to bear in mind is that there are two sort of outlooks. The bear market says the lagged effects of these higher rates will continue to hurt the economy, and we're going to have a recession. If we do, I think it'll be mild, but I could be wrong. Or there are other people that says, well, the economy is going to reaccelerate and drive inflation higher, preventing the Fed from making cuts that so many anticipate. Who knows? Anyway, thanks for tuning in, and Mike, we'll be back with you next week. This is Jim Harvey, president of Opus 111 Group, and I wish you guys the best week that you can have.
Join us again next week at this same time for the financial insight, opinion, and perspective of Money Management with Mike Mayo, powered by the Opus 111 Group. Have a question, comment, or want to find out if you'd be a good fit with Opus 111? Email us at info@opus111group.com or visit our website, opus111group.com. Sections of this radio show contain forward-looking statements that are not guarantees of future performance. This information is from sources we believe to be reliable. However, we cannot guarantee that it is accurate or complete. These comments are for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment advice, nor as a recommendation to buy or sell any security or investment product mentioned in this show. Investment involves risk and is not indicative of future results. Individual circumstances do vary. Please consult an investment professional prior to making any investment decisions.